Good morning, everybody.
As I start opening up all of the song that I have over here, you can turn to chapter 31, chapter Lamed Aleph. There are two parashiyot this week, Matot and Mas'ei. And what we're going to be learning is the beginning of chapter 31. And at the beginning of chapter 31, we're going to learn about the last battle, Moshe Rabbeinu's last battle, the last war that is fought in Torah. It's the last battle. It's a strange one. It is unusual. There's a great deal to learn from this battle. So that's what we're going to try and do, see if in some way we can make sense of what it is that is said here. Let's begin. Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe l'emor, God spoke to Moshe so saying, Nikom nikmad b'nei Yisrael me'eit hamidyanim. Nikom nikmad, revenge. Take the revenge of the children of Israel from the Midyanim. Achar, afterwards, te'osef el amecho, you will be gathered into your people. All of this is, of course, extremely strange. Moshe Rabbeinu's death is dependent, it is linked to this last battle, last struggle, last war. And even the terminology that's used, I think that we sometimes get a little hot on the collar when we think in terms of nekama, taking revenge. First of all, the background to this story. The background to the story is, of course, at the end of Parshas Balak. The end of Parshas Balak, Bilam advises Balak, king of Moab, that if you want to cause suffering to the Jewish people, then the way in which to do it is through an act of seduction. Eloheihem shalelu, their God, sonei zima, he hates immorality. And then we're told about a terrible story of the daughters of Moab and the daughters of Midian came out to the camp and they seduced some of the men of Israel and even brought them from the sin of immorality to the sin of adultery before Baal Peor. And then, of course, there's the horrible story of Zimri, who is a prince of the tribe of Shimon. And he engages in a relationship with Cosby Bastzur, who is a Midianite woman. And then Pinchas comes and he runs through the two of them. It was all a terrible, terrible story. And the Rebbe Shem says that the time has come to take revenge. And because here it was, the Midianites came out with the intent, well, maybe we'll use the term of immoralizing the camp. By creating immorality within the camp, they would demoralize. That's also not a bad word. To demoralize the camp. Empty the camp of its morality. Those are two good words I use. And the time has come to take revenge. We're going to get back to the term revenge because, we have this queasy feeling as though revenge is something, it does say in the Torah, lo tikom velo tito, you shouldn't hold a grudge, you shouldn't take revenge. And then very often we're always accused of taking revenge. Remember, I always used to love to point out and I remember hearing this from my brother. My brother, Hashem, of all things, today is his yahrzeit. I remember he used to get upset when in the Time magazine or the New York Times, when there was an attack by Israeli forces against some terrorist base. So usually the title would be Old Testament Eye for an Eye Revenge. So he would like to point out that there's a big difference between revenge and retaliation. If you hit me and I hit you back, That's retaliation. If I hit your son back or your daughter back, that's revenge. But if I strike back at the one who has struck me, this is not revenge. This is retaliation. That's precisely where you are supposed to hit. All right, but we'll talk a little bit later about the whole idea of nekama. Let's learn a few psukim. So here, okay, take nekama of the midyanim, and then, of course, what's the relationship between this and achar teil sefer amecha? Afterwards, you will be gathered to your people. So first of all, there are some important rashis that give us the background of what is happening over here. In the attack of seduction against the camp of Israel, it was not only the Midianites, it was the Moabites too. It was Moab and Midian. So why take revenge only of the Midianites? Why not the Moabites? So Rashi says, "V'lo me'eit ha-Moabim," not from the people of Moab. "Sha-ha-Moabim nichnusu le-dabar machmas yira." Rashi says, the people of Moab attempted to weaken the camp of Israel because they were afraid of an attack. They assumed that they were going to be attacked, and in a sense, it was their right of self-defense to go ahead and do what they can to weaken the camp of Israel. So the people of Moab were afraid of the Jews. So you show them because they may steal and rob and take from them. Because the only prohibition was that we were not permitted to wage war against them, but that didn't mean that Jews were not permitted to go ahead and strike at Moab. So Moab, in some sense, saw themselves threatened. And if they're threatened, it's their right of self-defense. Midyanim nit'avru ha'riv lo lahem. The Midyanim, who were not at all being threatened by the Jewish people at all, they entering into this fray, this was something that was just plain good old Sinas Yisrael. And Sinas Yisrael was quite rampant then too. In other words, when you find somebody who never met a Jew in his life and he hates Jews, so you understand that this is plain Sinas Yisrael. Midian was not threatened. Moab was threatened. And since Moab was threatened, they had a right. They had a right to do what they did. A second pshat, Rashi says, because from Ammon and Moab, I still have two very, very special people to take from there. There's going to be Ruth HaMoaviah and Naamah HaAmonit, two very special women. So therefore, Ammon and Moab can be allowed at this point in history to still remain without being attacked by the Jewish people. But Midian, no reason whatsoever for their involvement in this battle, therefore go take revenge. Vayedaber, the Pasuk 3 says, Vayedaber Moshe el ha'am lemar. Moshe spoke to the people saying, Hey, cholzu me'yidchem ha'moshim la'tzavah, you should take armed men from you for this art, for the force. V'yu ha'midyan, they shall go against Midyan, la'teit nikmat Hashem b'midyan, in order to bring the revenge of God against Midyan. A number of things from this pasuk. First of all, as Rashi points out, though Moshe knows that his death is linked to this, one would have been able to understand if Moshe would sort of put off the attack against Midian for some later date. You know, there's nothing wrong with redeploying against Midian another month from now, another 2 months from now. But Moshe Rabbeinu acts immediately. Immediately, says Rashi, "Afal pisha shoma shemisaso pluya badova." Though he heard that his death is linked to this, also besimcha, he did it with joy, velo icher, and he didn't tarry at all. Didn't tarry. I found a very fascinating sentence in the Or HaChaim HaKadosh that I'd like to elaborate on for a moment. I think it may very well give us an insight into what's happening here. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, Since God linked his death with the revenge taken against Midian, and to whom was the command? Who should take revenge? When God speaks to him, he says, Nikom Nikmat Bnei Yisrael, you should do it. But that's not what he's doing. He's going to hand over the task to others. How can he hand over the task to others if the job has been given to him? He's going to be sending Pinchas out to battle. So first of all, of course, simply when God says, take revenge, it means that you should be in charge of organizing the revenge to be taken. It doesn't necessarily have to mean that Moshe himself has to go. But more than that, the Arachaim says, since Moshe Rabbeinu's death will come after this battle, then it means by his making the arrangements for people to go out to war, he is being Moser Nefesh. He's not only sending others who will be endangering their lives. By him, it's more than endangering his life. He knows that his life will be over soon after this battle. Shehu Hanokein, he's considered the one who's taking revenge. Kihu Moser Nafsho Mamash Aladava, because Moshe is really acting with absolute Mesirat Nefesh. Shahagam Sheyodea, even though he knows Shebe'em Tsa'ut Kain, as a result of the battle against Midian, Yomut, he's going to die. Ahalpi Kain, despite that, Yomal Yisrael, he immediately tells Israel to go out to war. Ein lecha kiyum mitzvas bechol nafshecha kazum. There is no fulfillment of the mitzvah of the Ahavta, you should love God your God, bechol levavcha, u'vechol nafshecha, like this. I have the feeling that Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the one who gives Torah to the Jewish people, is the one who has to remain the model for all time, as the one who was able to fulfill Torah to its fullest. Let me explain what I mean. The Gemara tells us in its description of the death of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva died at the hands of Rome. He was put to death. They combed the skin off him with rakes of metal. Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest of the Tanoim, one of the greatest of all Jews of all history, and it says that when they began to remove the skin by the place where he kept his tefillin, he said Shema v'yotzeson yishmoso. He died when he said echad, and the Gemara says there that the students asked him when they saw him before how he did not seem to be disturbed about the fact that he's going to die such a terrible death. So Rabbi Akiva is the one who said, "Kol yomai hayisi mitzar al pasuk zeh." My whole life I was troubled about this pasuk of the Ahavta Hashem Elokecha. I will love God your God b'chol levavcha u'b'chol nafshecha, with your whole life, even if he demands your life of you, be ready to give it. Kol yomai, all of my life I was troubled about this pasuk. Masai yavo liyadi, when will it happen? When will I have the opportunity to give my life, v'achaimena, and I will fulfill it? This is Rabbi Akiva. Moshe Rabbeinu, who is Torah itself, should have the opportunity at some point of demonstrating that he is a model of true love of God. Do you know what that means? He has to be given the opportunity of fulfilling a mitzvah, even if his life depends on it, even if it means that his life will come to an end as a result. And I believe that's what the Arachayim is saying. The Rebbeinu Shalom has given Moshe Rabbeinu the opportunity. He has linked the two. He has linked Moshe's life with this battle, so that Moshe, for all intents and purposes, can say, ah, this is it. This is the opportunity. If God forbid I hesitate now, I will not have fulfilled the mitzvah of Bechol Nafshecha. But if I'm ready and I do it now, and as he says, Besimcha, That's what they use, the term similar to how they described Rabbi Akiva b'Simcha. It's not the only time. Remember, Moshe Rabbeinu is also the one who remains a model for Klal Yisrael of B'chol Ma'odecha. B'chol Ma'odecha means even money, loss of money, if that's what love of God entails, be ready to do it. When did that happen? When Klal Yisrael is going out of Mitzrayim, God begs Moshe, and Moshe begs the Jewish people, empty Mitzrayim of its wealth. While Jews are in the process of emptying Mitzrayim of all of its wealth, which was a big mitzvah, it is a big mitzvah. What's Moshe Rabbeinu doing? Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who is totally unconcerned with all the wealth that, you know, he too could become a wealthy man, but he goes looking for the bones of Yosef. Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvos. A pasuk in Mishle, Chacham Lev, a person who is wise of heart, he takes mitzvahs. Zem Moshe, that refers to Moshe, because it says by Moshe, Vayikach Moshe et atzmot Yosef imo. Moshe Rabbeinu took atzmot Yosef, the bones of Yosef. That means money meant nothing to him, only the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now his life, he's ready to lay down his life. So that he has been given the opportunity of Mesiras Nefesh. That's what I'm reading into the words of the Arachayim. Ein chokiyum mitzvahs b'chol nafshecha kizu. There is no fulfillment like of the mitzvah of b'chol nafshecha like this one. He knows that he's going to die as a result of the fulfillment of this mitzvah. There are other things that are important here. Moshe Rabbeinu's relationship to this. To this mitzvah, and maybe we can answer a number of the questions that we have already asked. Why the Midyanim, and why not the Midyanim, and why not the Moavim? So Rashi gave two answers. One answer was at least Moav was not to be destroyed because Moav was acting in what they saw as self-defense. The second is because there's still Rut HaMoaviyah to come from Moab. But you know, there's always a always another answer. Why the Midyanim? Why is revenge to be taken of them now and not from the Moavim? And furthermore, if Moshe Rabbeinu's time has come to die, Why indeed should it be linked? Why should it be linked to the to this revenge, for that matter? Or why does he have to do it? Can't Yehoshua do it? Who was the first one that Moshe Rabbeinu sent out to wage war? First, the sneak attack of Amalek at the end of Parshat Bishalach. Moshe said to Yeshua, "B'chal onu anoshim, choose men v'tzehi lachem b'amalek, and go wage war with Amalek." Why does this have to be Moshe Rabbeinu's last battle? Why is this his last battle? Because it seems, from the way the pasuk says it, "Nekal nikmat b'nei Yisrael me'etav yedanim achar te'aseif ha'amecha." The way the pasuk is written, it means you should die, but you can't die yet. You can't die yet. What has to happen first is you have to take revenge of the Midyanim. I believe that there's something very, very important that's being said over here. By Moshe being the one who wages the war against Midyan, what Moshe Rabbeinu is doing in this battle, in this struggle, with him at the helm, he as the commander-in-chief of the forces of Israel, he saves Torah. He saves all of Torah. His Torah, he saves. Because there's still a cheshbon here. Let's say there still may very well be a question in the minds of Jews. What was it that Zimri ben Salu had done? Zimri ben Salu, Chazal tells us on the basis of Pesukim at the end of Parshas Balak, Zimri ben Salu is the one What did the pasuk say? I'll read that pasuk at the end of Balak. It says the following: V'hinei ish mibnei Yisrael, a man came from Israel. V'yakrev le'achav et ha-midyanit, he brought the Midianite woman le'enei Moshe, in the eyes of Moshe, u'le'enei kol adav b'nei Yisrael, in the eyes of all of the children of Israel. Who's the Midianite woman? Cosby Batzor. He brought Cosby into the presence of Moshe. Le'enei Moshe. Anulo. They said to Moshe, Zu asura, this woman is prohibited, or this woman is permitted to us. Im toma asura, if you're going to tell me that this woman is prohibited, but Yisro mihiti lecha, who permitted you the daughter of Yisro? She's a Midianite. In other words, Zimri is challenging Moshe publicly. You're going to tell me that this woman is prohibited? But you married a Midianite woman. But what happens at that point? Who is the one that is the kanoi? Who is the one that acts? Who's the one that acts? Not Moshe. The one who acts then is Pinchas. Pinchas is the one who stands up from amongst the community. He takes the spear and he runs Zimri and Cosby through. Is it possible that the Jew who was out there in the camp may not know the answer to the question, why is the daughter of Yitro permitted to you and Zimri cannot have Cosby? Is it possible that somebody in the camp might think, why didn't Moshe indeed take up the banner of the battle? Who's the one that fights the battle? The one that does it is Pinchas? Moshe cannot permit that question to remain unanswered. He cannot permit any doubt to remain in the minds of anybody in Klal Yisrael. They have to know the halacha. They have to know the halacha that a Midianite woman is a shiksa, she's awesome. They will also have to know the halacha that Moshe had married the daughter of Yisro before Matan Torah, and at Matan Torah all the non-Jews, the eight of Rav, became Jews at Matan Torah. But now we're 40 years later, this is 40 years after Torah has been given. They have to know that halacha, they have to know all of these halachas. If they're not going to know these halachas, but they're going to remain with the question in their mind, well, Moshe didn't say much to Zimri. Moshe is not the one who ran Zimri through. Who indeed permitted him to marry the daughter of Yitro, a Midianite? So therefore, number one, there has to be a battle against Midian. And Moshe has to be the one who wages the battle. It cannot be left for the time after Moshe has passed the sea. Because as the battle is going to unfold, they're going to bring the women of Midian back, and Moshe is going to get angry and tell him the law is that they have to be put to death. What Moshe Rabbeinu is doing with this struggle, he is making clear, he's giving finally the answer to the Jewish people. He is telling them, yes, Sipporah was permitted to him because he had married her before Torah was given at Sinai. And she became a geyoret, just like all Jews became geyim at Mamre Har Sinai. And what's taking place now, what took place now, what Zimri did, was absolutely prohibitive. That's what they have to know. And that message has to come from Moshe. Otherwise there will always remain the doubt. Why didn't Moshe answer Zimri? Why was it Pinchas who got up and did that which was supposed to be done. So that's the alright, let's continue a little further in the Pesukim. There are a number of other major ideas that arise here in the Pesukim. Alright, so Moshe immediately tells them, let's go to battle. And interestingly, on that Pasuk Gimel, though Rashi has said it a number of times in Torah, there must be reason why he chooses to say it again. In Pasuk 3, again, Vayedaber Moshe el Ha'am Leimor, and Moshe spoke to the people saying, Heicholtzu me'idchem anashim la'tzava. Anashim, says Rashi, tzadikim. Now the fact is, Rashi doesn't always say tzadikim. If I'm not mistaken, didn't we have a Rashi like that in last week's sedra? Huh? Yeah, there it was, anashim and not nashim. We had this, first of all, it said it by the Meraglim, Kulam Anoshim Roshe Bnei Yisrael Hema, and it says that they were righteous people, Kshedim Hoyu Baotasha, they were kosher at that time. And then we had it one other, but didn't we have it last? Why am I thinking of last week? All right, it'll come to me. Oh, but what bothers me over here is, why does Rashi have to repeat it again? He has said it a number of times in Torah. I think it's going to be very important that the people who are going to go out to battle over here are going to be chosen not by virtue of how strong they are or how well trained they are. They have to be absolutely righteous. And watch. Elef lamata, 1,000 from each tribe, 1,000 from each tribe, l'chol matot Yisrael, from all of the tribes of Israel. Tishlechu latzavah, you should send them out to war. It means they're not going to send the entire camp. 12,000 men are going to go out to battle against Midian. 12,000 men. Why 12,000 men? Why not as many men as you need? Maybe the great mystery will be answered later when they check through the roster of the 12,000. Into the valley of death went the 12,000, and you know how many came back? 12,000. Lo nifkad mimenuish, not a single one fell in battle. Nobody fell in battle. And I believe the reason why nobody fell in battle is because Rashi wants to point out at the very beginning, these are all tzaddikim. And do you know why they all have to be tzaddikim? Because these are people who are going in order to take revenge of what Midian had done to the camp. These have to be people who the thought of immorality had never crossed their minds. The only one, I'm afraid to use the term because it won't be understood, but let me tell you the truth. You know what kind of war this is? A holy war. Except, you know, the moment we talk about holy war, everybody begins to think already of jihad. But, you know, I don't mean jihad, you know, a holy war, like all holy wars. This is a different holy war. This is a real holy war. Here was an attempt at poisoning an entire people. And they are sending a force out against Midian to crush the immorality of Midian. The only one who's capable of doing that is the one who himself is personally, absolutely above any kind of suspicion. A person who himself, during the attack of immorality, that came from Midian, had not fallen prey to that attack. Elef lamata, elef lamata. Vayimosru me'alfe Yisrael elef lamata. From each tribe of Israel, and Rashi points out tribes over here different than the usual number of tribes. The tribe of Levi is counted over here, and Menashe and Ephraim are all going to go together as one, are going to unite under the banner of Yosef. You know already at this point in time, there aren't 12 tribes, there are 13 tribes. Yosef has become Menashe and Ephraim, and Levi is really the number 13. 12 tribes are going to have a share in Eretz Yisrael. The 13th, which is Levi, is not going to have a share in Eretz Yisrael. Why now? Rashi points out that it's Levi now, which obviously means that Menashe and Ephraim have to be Yosef. Why are they going under the banner of Yosef and not as Menashe and Ephraim? I believe the reason why they're going under the banner of Yosef, who was the one that was able to withstand seduction? Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik because he was able to withstand it. When Menashe and Ephraim go out as Yosef, they are making a statement, a moral statement. Vayimasru, beautiful Rashi. I think there's a Rashi here. Sure, there has to be a Rashi here. Yeah, there is. Okay, I found it. Vayimasru means sort of that people were in some way coerced in order to join these forces. So Rashi says, Lahudia Shivcham Shel Roi Yisrael, this comes to tell you the praise of the leaders of Israel. Kama Hem Chavivim Al Yisrael, how beloved they are by Israel, how people loves its leaders, how Israel loves its leaders. Listen to this. Before they heard about the possibility of the death of Moshe, Mahu Omer, what does it say in Torah? Moshe complains, Od Ma'atu Skaluni, any minute now they're going to stone me to death. But the moment the Jews hear that Moshe Rabbeinu's death is linked to this battle, nobody wants to go to battle. Nobody wants to go. In other words, as long as, you know, everybody seems to be alive, at Min Ois Mitchin, they will complain against their leadership. They will find fault with their leadership. Metzay in Tait Machin, until there's the possibility, Taka, that the Tait is dependent and linked to all of this. As long as, you know, things are just fine, so then Moshe Rabbeinu can say, Od Matu Skoluni, these people are going to stone me to death. But the moment that they hear that, they, Moshe Rabbeinu, because that's what it said, he tells them over the mitzvah, Nikon Nikmas Bnei Yisrael, Achate Yosef El Amecha, El Amecha, they know that Moshe is going to die after this. Says Rashi, Umishishomu Shemisas Moshe Tluya B'Nikmas Migan, and when they heard that the death of Moshe is dependent on taking revenge of Midian, they didn't want to go. They were forced, people had to force them to go to battle. We should have taken note of something that's fascinating. Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Bet and Pasuk Gimel. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, I want you to take revenge, the revenge of the children of Israel. What does Moshe say? He tells Klal Yisrael, Nikmat Hashem b'Midyan, the revenge of God in Midyan. I mean, who are we avenging here? Is this the revenge of Moshe, of Yisrael, or the revenge of God? So first of all, what's being established over here is the idea that Klal Yisrael and the Rebbeinu Shem are a mutual admiration society. Where it's really expressed better than anything else is famous Vort, I think, is a It's said by many. We call the Yontif Pesach. Torah calls the Yontif Chag HaMatzos. Why do we call it Pesach and the Torah calls it Chag HaMatzos? We call it Pesach because what we want to project is what God did for us, that He passed over our houses in Mitzrayim. When the Rebbeinu Shem talks about the Yontif, he wants to project, look at what my Jews do. They fulfill the mitzvah of matzos. It's the mutual admiration society. What's the Rebbeinu Shem concerned about? He is concerned about the revenge of Bnei Yisrael. Midian did something terrible to Yisrael, and I can't stand it. I want revenge to be taken. What does Moshe Rabbeinu say to the Klal Yisrael? What they did to Klal Yisrael was a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. And therefore, I want us to go out to battle so that we should revenge the revenge of God in Midian. And here Rashi also makes a comment that we have been, I think we've been adding them up through Torah. When it says Nikmas Hashem, the revenge of God, says Rashi, Lefi sha'amdu keneged Yisrael, because Midian stood up against Israel. Nechshavu heim, it is considered keilu amdu keneged HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's considered as though they stood up against God. To stand up against Israel is standing up against God. Where else, on a number of occasions, I've asked you, where else do we have this idea that the one who wages war with Israel, it's considered as though he's waging war with God? The first place where it is expressed is in the Shira, in Parshas Bishalach. Uberov goncha taharos kamecha, with your great pride you crush those who stand up against you, says Rashi. Tomid atahores kamecha, you always crush those who rise up against you. Hakamim, those who stand up negdecha, against you. Umihem ha'omdim hakamim kinegdo, who are the ones that stand up against God? I mean, who around here on the face of this earth is waging war with God? Umihem hakamim kinegdo. Elu hakamim al Yisrael, says Rashi. Those who rise up against Israel are those who rise up against God. V'chein hu omer, and so it says the second chapter in Tehillim, ki hine oyevecho yehemoyun, behold, your enemies are making a lot of noise. Your enemies, God, your enemies are making a lot of noise. You know that they call international conferences, they get together, they fly around the world to meet. You hear all sorts of noises and saber rattling. Your enemies are the ones who make all of the noise. Asks Rashi, Umahi Hahemya, what is the noise that they make? Says David HaMelech in Tehillim, Al Amcha Ya'arimu Sod, against your people, they are plotting secrets against your people. Those who plot against the Jewish people are called Oivav Shel Makom, the enemies of God. Where else do we have this idea? I always forget some of the psukim, but I remember some of them. Vayehi bin Soa Ha'aron Vayomem Moshe, when the ark moved, journeyed, Vayomem Moshe Kuma Hashem, arise O God, v'yafutsu ayivecha, your enemies should be dispersed. V'yanusu misanecha mipanecha, those who hate you shall flee from before you. Who is it that's God's enemy? The enemies of Israel are the enemies of God. That's what Rashi is expressing here. When Moshe Rabbeinu says, Nikmat Hashem the Midyan, what do you mean? What did Midyan have to do with God? What did Midyan have to do? Because they are the enemies of Israel, they are the enemies of God, the Rebbeinu. Those who rise up against Israel, they rise up against Israel, they would want to wage war with God. They would want to do battle with Him. The best way to do it is to wage war against the Jewish people. So you have to take revenge. You have to take revenge. Torah says, "Lo tikom v'lo titar." Torah says you shouldn't take revenge. And here, God Himself is the one who commands that a war should take place, and the purpose of the war is to take revenge. So, well, and there is a pasuk in Tehillim where the pasuk says, "Yismach tzaddik," let the tzaddik be happy. Ki chazon nokom, because he has seen revenge. David HaMelech refers to God as Hakeil Hanotein Nekamot Li, the God who gives me revenge of my enemies. Later on in Devarim, it's going to say in Hazinu Li Nokom, to me there is revenge. Gemara says Gedola Nekama, great is revenge. Shenitna ben shtei otyot, it's given between the two names of God, Keil Nekamot Hashem. God is the God of revenge. The name of God on one side of the word Nekama, the name of God on the other side of the word Nekama. There's something, not only is something, I'm not talking about something very sweet about revenge, I'm talking about something that is very holy about revenge. The fact is, when it comes down to the bottom line, the real holiness of revenge is the following. The great Chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name in history, is when evil reigns. What do we feel? What does man think? When there's evil in the world, where's the Ribbono Shel Olam? Why doesn't he strike down these wicked and evil people? When will there be an end to evil? The existence of evil in the world is a Chilul Hashem. It's a desecration of God's name. God's world should be a world of good, a world of peace, where there is evil and the evil are permitted to reign. This is Chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. And when the evil receive their just deserts, then we're talking about Kiddush Shem Shemaim. There is an Akama, which is the really ultimately the end of history, when evil is completely removed from the world. Isn't that what we daven for on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? Isn't that what we say in Aleinu every day? The removal of all evil from upon the face of this earth, because evil is the antithesis of the existence of God in this world. Evil is the antithesis of God's presence in this world. The destruction of evil is Kiddush, is a sanctification of God's name. So that it's not so simple, in other words, to take revenge. For example, in the Gemara, when the Gemara talks about the halacha of revenge, that you're not permitted to take revenge, which is so. So first of all, the Gemara says that it refers to matters of money. For example, the Gemara says the following: if I ask somebody, lend me your hatchet, and he says, no, I don't lend it to you, and then the next day he asks me for something and I say, you didn't lend me your hatchet yesterday, I'm not going to lend you something today, that's nekoma. Netira is when a fellow comes the next day to ask something to me, and he asks me for something, so I say to him, you didn't lend me your hatchet, but you want my car, you can have my car, I'm not like you. That's lotikom velotito. These are prohibited. So first the Gemara says it seems to that nekoma and netira that the Torah prohibited is talking only about matters of that involve money. What about tsaro deguba? Somebody caused you pain. Nothing to do with money. Somebody causes you pain. Somebody causes you anguish. So the Gemara talks about this possibility. The tsaro deguba. What about pain that somebody did to you? So what? You have to forgive. So first the Gemara asks, it says the following famous Gemara, Hamelovim ve'enam olvim, the ones who are shamed and embarrassed, but they don't shame and embarrass somebody back, Shomim cherpatam, the ones who are able to hear how they are accursed, ve'enam mishivim, and they don't respond, Osim me'ava, those are the people who perform mitzvahs with love, usmeichim biyisurim, and accept suffering with joy. Aleihem akatuv haomer, about them the pasuk says, v'ohavav kitzeit hashemesh bigvurato, those who love God are going to be in their strength like the sun coming out upon the face of the earth. The Gemara at the end says that al tzar haguf mutal anelav lishmar et tzaro belivo. Now, if somebody caused me physical pain, or somebody caused me emotional pain, I do have a right to remember it. I don't have to simply on matters of money, Dr. Michael Zayn, but on other things, I don't have to forgive. Despite that, the Gemara asks, But v'hokol ha'maver al midotav ma'avina lo akol pshav. The Gemara says, if a person is able to overcome his natural bent and inclination, in other words, my natural inclination. So the fact is, when no. Wait. The Gemara says even more. The Gemara says. So the Gemara asks, what about personal pain? Do you have to forgive? So the Gemara says, no. You don't have to forgive. The only time you should be ready to forgive is the mefayis lay umefayis. If somebody is going to come and say, you know, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I feel badly about the pain that I caused you. So then it says that you should be appeased. You should accept the apology. But if somebody causes you mental anguish or physical pain, there's no such thing that says that, you know, I have to forget and I have to forgive and I have to permit bygones to be bygones. That already requires a level of piety, and I'm not so certain that there is really piety involved in it. People should not be able to just cause pain and suffering to others and get away with it. Can't do it. But if it's a matter of money, guilt is blotter. Yeah, I mean, that's what we're supposed to look at it. Anyway, in light of the larger view of life. All right, let's go. There's so much to say in this last battle. So let's go a little further in the psukim. Vayishlach otam Moshe sent them 1,000 lamate latzavah. He sent them 1,000 men from each tribe latzavah to war. Otam that Pinchas ben Elazar akoyin latzavah, them and Pinchas. You know why Pinchas is going to be the commander? Pinchas is the commander because he was the one that started the battle. He was the one that began the mitzvah. He was the one that ran Zimri through. Let him be the one who finishes and completes the battle. Uklei HaKodesh, the Klei HaKodesh, the holy items, the Oro went out with them, and the tzitz of the Kohen Gadol. The tzitz was the golden plate that set on it Kodesh Vashem, that the Kohen Gadol wore on his brow. So this is the this went out to them, the chatzotzos hatruah biyado, and the trumpets in his hand. Vayitzbu'u al Midyan, and they waged war against Midyan. Kasher tzivah Hashem et Moshe, as God commanded Moshe. Vayahargu kol zohar, and they killed all males. That malchei Midyan hargu al chaleim, the kings of Midyan, they killed al chaleim. We're going to get back to the word al chaleim right away. Al chaleim, upon the dead bodies of the others. And who are the kings of Midyan? Evi and Rekem and Tzur and Chur and Deva. Chameshet malchei Midyan, the five kings of Midyan. And you know who also, fascinatingly enough, happened to be there at the time that Bilam ben Baor horgu bechorak. Bilam, the son of Baor, was killed by the sword, which, according to some of the Mefarshim, is one of the reasons why the battle had to take place then. Bilam, they knew, was in Midyan. Why had Bilam, Rashi explains, why had Bilam come to Midyan? Because Bilam came to collect his fee. His cursing fee. He wasn't able to curse the Jewish people, but he gave them advice. He gave Moab and Midian advice how to cause suffering to the Jewish people. The seduction of the women of Midian. So that means when he's there, that's when the battle has to take place. So they should be able to get Bilam. Beautiful Rashi. Just this is something that you should know. Why does it say Al Chalaleim? So you see, we as children of the 20th century, we think, of course, that man's first venture into the air took place when and where? What year? Huh? 19 3? Wasn't it 06? Kitty Hawk. The Wright brothers. Wrong. That's not when the first manned flight took place. Rashi says, Shehayah Bilam Imahem. Bilam was with them. I'm reading the Rashi. It's just such a fascinating, such a beautiful Rashi. Rashi says Bilam was with them. Umafriach Malchei Midyan Bikshafim. The kings of Midyan were able to fly through his magic. Man flight. Vuhu Atzmo Poreach Imahem. And he himself was flying with them over the battlefield. So you needed a patriot to bring them down. What was going to bring them down from man magic flight? That's why Pinchas took the tzitz. They aimed the tzitz at the kings of Midian and Bilam, and that was the first anti-aircraft. It says Hedolahem et tzitz. He showed them the tzitz. Shahashem Chokukbo, that the name of God is engraved on it, Vehem Noflim, and they fell. Lakach Nema, that's why it says in the Pasuk, Al Chalaleim, the kings of Midian and Bilam fell upon the dead bodies on the field of battle. The Malchim Midian, Shenoflim Ala Chalaleim, Min Ha'avir, from the air. Vehem Bilam, by Bilam it also says, Al Chalaleim. The Sefer Yoshua, in Yoshua, when it's going to tell us again the story of the death of Bilam, it describes Bilam falling upon the dead on the field of battle. Because here it was, first man flight, of course, ended up a great deal more tragic, at least the Wright brothers. In other words, if you want to talk about the first man flight that ended successfully, where man was able to come down to earth alive, that was the Wright brothers. But this first venture into space simply failed miserably. I'm getting into this difficult moment where I'm not even going to be able to say the shiur that I planned on saying today. You know, with just about 15 minutes to go. So let's do a little... A few more psukim, and then I'll take you where I want to go to. By Yishgu b'nei Yisrael b'shem Midyan, the children of Israel captured the women of Midyan and the children that called them tom, and all of their animals that called them, all their cattle that called chelom basosim, and all of their wealth they took as spoil. That called orei and the moshvotam, all of their cities and their dwelling places that's called tirotam, and all of their fortresses sorful beish, they burned in fire. By Yiku et kol hashalal, they took all of the spoil. That kol ha-malkoach, the malkoach represents the living spoil, men and animals, ba'adam u'behemah. Vayoviu el Moshe, they brought it to Moshe and to Elazar HaKohen, v'latat b'nei Yisrael, et ha-shviv, et ha-malkoach, et ha-shalal, el ha-machne, they brought it all to the camp, el arvo, Moab asher, al yarden yirecho, to the plains of Moab, which is upon yarden yirecho. In other words, here the Pasuk really telling us that, like, this is it, now they are indeed encamped along the plains of Moab, ready to go into Eretz Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to get very upset with them that they left the women alive, and he's going to call for the destruction of any women who had known men, which of course gives Moshe, therefore, the opportunity to do that which Pinchas had begun, to make it certain that the women of Midian are prohibited, but his wife was permitted to him. I want to take, just jump with me to Pasuk 21. Because that's really what I wanted to talk about today. But all right, listen, we'll do the best we can. Next year, we'll be able to learn the parasha again. Elazar the Kohen said to the people of the army who had come into war, Zot Chukat HaTorah, this is the law of Torah, Asher Tzivah Hashem et Moshe, that God has commanded Moshe. Two very, very important psukim. And these two very important psukim that are said now are important for us as halacha up until today. I mean, this is eternal halacha that is being settled here. Ach et hazohav et hakesef, the gold and the silver, et hanachoshet, the brass or the copper, et habarzel, the metal, et habdil, tin, ve'et ha'oferet, and lead. Kol dovar ashiyava bo'esh, anything that comes through fire, Ta'aviru be'esh petoher. You should take it through fire and purify it. Ach b'mei nida yitchata. Except that it should go through the waters of nida. We'll see in a moment what that means. Whatever does not go through fire, ta'aviru b'mayim, you should take it through water. V'chitastem b'gdechem b'yom ha'shviyu ta'atem, you should wash your garments on the seventh day and become Torah. V'achar tavor al ha'machna, and afterwards you should go to the machna. In those two psukim, psukim 22 and 23, two major halachas for all time are being said to Klal Yisrael. One is the halacha of kashering. Kashering! And the basic principle of kashering something to remove the treif that is in it. They're coming back with all sorts of metal pots and pans. They took a lot of spoil. But these goyim had been using it for treifes. All right, I don't know, Midian's McDonald's. They bring the kalim back. You have to kasher the kalim before you can use it. So the general rule is, and that's the rule of thumb. The rule of thumb is the way in which something which is treif is absorbed is the way you remove it. If it went through fire, then you're going to have to remove it through fire. If it came into the keli through water, then you use water. In other words, there we have the libun. Libun is, you know, what we do with our stoves and our ovens before Pesach. Stoves and ovens are used with heat without water, so you have to put on the heat in order to us to glean to. Kikabolo kachpolto, the way in which it's absorbed is the way in which it is removed. Anything that goes through fire, so therefore you're supposed to put it through fire, and that's the way you're going to remove it. If it's through hot water, so you do hagola. So if it's hot water, so that's how you catch it, with hot water. But in middle here, there is something that is a little different. Ach b'mei nida yitchata, it should be purified through Mei Nida. What does this mean through Mei Nida? Brings Rashi what the Gemara tells us. V'rabotenu dorshu mikan. Our rabbis learn from here. Sha'af la'achshiron min ha'isur hit on tvilo l'klei matches. In addition to the fact that you have to remove the treifus that's in these kelim, a keli that you get from a goy, you have to take it to the mikveh. Ach, b'mei nida yitchata, you're supposed to purify it through the waters of nida. What are the waters of nida? The water in which a nida purifies herself, which is a mikveh. You have to take the keli to the mikveh. This is the halacha that's brought in the Mishnah and in the Shulchan Aruch. Klei se'uda, the kelim for a meal. Hanil kochim min ha'akum, that you buy from a guy, you have to take it to the mikveh. I remember when I was a student here in yeshiva in 1955, so I bought a few glasses and I was learning then in Panovich. I took it to the mikveh in Bnei Brak and I want to table it. So the fellow in the mikveh says, what are you bringing us? I said, listen, I bought some glasses, you know, I want to table it. He says, where did you buy it? I said, I bought it here. He says, take a look, where was it made? Turns out it was made in Israel. Made in Israel, made by in a Jewish factory, then you don't have to. By the way, that's when Israel was a poor country. So if you had to buy a glass, you bought a glass that was made in Israel. Today it's a rich country, you can't find anything. You go into the Mashbir and everything is from every place in the world, you understand? From Italy, from France, from Hong Kong. Today the guy in the mikveh in Bnei Brak wouldn't ask me where I bought it. But then, hardly anybody brought kelim to the mikveh to be titled, but here I'm, you know, just from my accent, and it hasn't changed much in 40 years, you understand. But my accent, he knew that I was an Americaner, so obviously I didn't know that what you buy in Eretz Yisrael was made in Eretz Yisrael. But today, what you buy in Eretz Yisrael isn't necessarily made in Eretz Yisrael, so you have to take things to the mikveh. What's the general rule of thumb? The rule of thumb is anything that's metal or glass has to be taken to the mikveh. You have to say a bracha, asher kedushanu b'mitzvosa v'tzidonu, if it's one keli, al tvilat keli. If it's more than one keli, al tvilat kelim. Wood, you don't have to table, you don't have to table earthenware, you don't have to table plastics. Don't ask me about Karel. You don't have to table Karel. You don't have to table Melmac. Anybody have any shilas now? We can give you the whole list of what you don't have to table.
I heard China,
you don't have to table.
I
just said it. I said earthenware.
Right.
I said earthenware. There are those who are machmer. There are those who are machmer if there's like gold or silver or some kind of a metal on it to table without a bracha. Most of the China, you don't have to. You're going to have to title change. All right. Okay, what, any other heterim anybody's looking for? The basic things that you have to title are metal and glass. Plastics, or all those that are certainly kalim that are not from natural products, but from manufactured products, you don't have to, you don't have to take it to me. And of course, it only means kalim that are clay suuda, only thing. Of course, there are questions. Some of the questions are, what do you do about metal? What do you do about electric plug-in kalim? Do you have to take that? Is it going to ruin the... there are two approaches. One approach, of course, is, that I hear this from a lot of people, that if you do immerse the whole... Well, there are three approaches. One is to immerse it up until the element. Why am I doing this? One is up until the element. The other is, there are those who say that if you table the whole thing and then you wait about 3-4 days until it dries out completely, there's nothing wrong, because if you plug it in with water in there, that's the end of the keli. And I'll tell you, my Rosh Hashiva used to pass on something else. My Rosh Hashiva used to pass on electric kelim you can only use when they are plugged in. If they are plugged in, then they no longer have the halacha of being a movable keli. A keli that you have to tell has to be something that is movable, portable. But if the only way that it works is because it's plugged into the electric system, it becomes, from that moment on, it's not a movable keli anymore. All right, then I understand that there are all sorts of shilas with regard to some of us. Many of us, maybe all of us, have difficulty throwing out coffee jars, jam jars. We end up in a jam, jarred up with all the jars that we have. I know there are times that when I'm not seen, I throw, you know, a few hundred of them into the garbage. That's what happened to them, yeah. Do you have to use? Do you have? You know, when you decide that you want to use it, do you have to cash it out? Why am I doing this? I have so little time left. Or foil. That's the next thing. Or foil. What do you do? So, the fact is, I understand that today in my days we did not tell them. You know, but I'm part of the a previous generation. I understand now you table it. But the fact is the following. The way I remember the halacha was in my days, well, when you buy it, let's say you buy a coffee jar. You're not buying the jar. You're buying the coffee. The only thing is they want you to take home the coffee. So they give you a jar to take home the coffee. So it's not called that you're buying a keli from a guy. I'm buying coffee from the guy. I'm not buying the keli from the guy. Which means that if I never want to acquire it, so I can continue using it. They don't mind if I use it, but it remains the keli of a guy. And by the way, that brings me to another important halacha. And that halacha is, it's only kelim that I buy from a guy have to be taken to the mikveh. What happens if it's kelim that I borrow or I rent? I'm making a simcha in the house, in Chutz Laretz, and I rent from a rental agency new kelim that they never use. So there's no problem, they're not treif. I don't have to table that which I rent or that which I borrow. What this whole shiur was supposed to be about, and I'm going to have to do it now in 2 or 3 minutes. What is the halacha of tvilas kelim? What's the meaning of the halacha? Why is there a halacha that you have to immerse kelim in the mikveh? And why is this halacha being said now after the last battle that was fought in Chutz Laaretz. So somebody said very, very beautifully, and this is an idea, of course, that has to be elaborated upon. Before Klal Yisrael enters Eretz, so the next battle is going to be Yahushua conquering the land. And what the Torah wants to teach a Jewish people that are going to establish themselves as an independent people in Eretz Yisrael, that anything that is basic, a basic necessity of life, you can never depend on anybody else. It has to be made by yourself. You can't, under any circumstances, ever leave yourself in the position where pots and pans and glasses and dishes, which are the basic necessities of life, it's all right, we'll buy it from Goyim. I don't have to make my own. There's something so wrong about the idea. There's something so bad about it that it can very well eat away at the very foundations of Jewish independence. And therefore the Torah tells Halacha now, the last Halacha to be told them, last battle before they're going to go into Eretz Yisrael. You're going to have to make sure that whatever is necessary as basic for your life must be made by Yiddish hand. It has to be kachol lavan, blue or white. You can't leave yourself in the position that pushes a pot with which to cook, a glass from which to drink, that you get from Goyim. If you are going to buy it from Goyim, it's going to have to go through a process whereby it's reborn as made by Yiddish hand, by taking it through the mikveh. That's what you're going to have to do. So where was the halacha said? The halacha was said with regard to glass and metal, which all kalim, whatever you really need, you can have from glass and metal. Anything else is no longer the basic and fundamental items that are necessary. Be it the plastics, be it anything else, in the natural world, glass and metal is that which makes all that's required for one to eat. We don't usually live on borrowed or rented kelim. That's a yotzei min haklal, the unusual. Halacha never doesn't have to deal with that kind of an unusual, because no people are going to live on borrowed F-15s or borrowed Sherman tanks. You understand? Or the halacha that's being established, the idea that is being implanted in Klal Yisrael now, is that anything that's necessary for your survival and independence as a people has to come from you. You can't, for example, subcontract the fight against terrorism to somebody else. They'll fight terrorism for us. No siree. Unless you want to take all of those fighters and put them through a mikveh. But they're not the ones that are going to do it. Whenever Klal Yisrael was in the position that it had to depend on others for the basic necessities of life, to the extent that they were dependent on others, that was a loss of their own independence. They were never able, couldn't survive. You can't survive when you are dependent on others for those things that are so basic and so fundamental and so important to daily life. And that's the idea of tefillah in the mikveh. We're not talking about the fact that because a goy made it, therefore there's something bad about this pot, there's something impure or unclean or contaminated. That's not what we're talking about. There's nothing contaminated about it. There's nothing impure or unclean about it. But it's bad for you. It's bad for you. And even in a world that is so interdependent upon one another, you go into a store and you get every stuff made from. You want to learn geography. You want to learn geography today, all you have to do is go into the Majbir. Echveis from Sri Lanka, from Singapore, from Taiwan, from China. You understand? A whole world. But it can't ever be so with regard to that which is necessary for our survival. what's necessary for your survival, you have to be able to produce it yourself. And if you can't produce it yourself, you're going to be in terrible, terrible tzachon. That's the idea of Tfilas Kelim. That's the idea. That's really what I wanted to talk about, but then I would have gone off into all sorts of other things. The extent to which we are dependent upon the United States of America is the extent to which we are not an independent people in our own land. And the sooner and the quicker we can become independent of the United States and an American aid, and I'll tell you, I would be ready to lower my standard of living, my place's standard of living. I'm ready to lower my standard of living together with everybody else in this country and tell the United States of America, Clinton, Bill, Hillary, I don't even need your playpen for my kids. I can bring my own playpen from Eretz Yisrael. I don't need you. The extent, that's the halakha of Tfilas Kelim. Independence means, and that's what they have to know right before they go into Eretz Yisrael. Independence means you have to be able to create and make the necessities of life yourself. That's it.